Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 140. It's Monday, November 29th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, continues to be big news with COVID-19. The big one in the last week, of course, is the new variant of concern. So let's do a story on that. This from Stat News. What's known and unknown about Omicron, the coronavirus variant identified in South Africa? Scientists in South Africa have identified a new coronavirus variant with a worrisome combination of mutations that experts fear could make it more transmissible and allow it to evade immune protection, including the protection generated by vaccines. Experts are scrambling to learn more about the variant, known by its scientific name, B.1.1.529, and called Omicron by the World Health Organization. Right now, there are more open questions than firm answers. And although scientists have expressed significant early concern over the variant, the WHO designated it as a variant of concern last Friday. They have cautioned that they are still seeking critical information about it. One reminder, there have been a series of variants that have caused initial alarm, only to prove largely unimportant in the course of the pandemic. Where has it been detected? Scientists in South Africa detected the lineage last Monday, according to the country's National Institute for Communicable Diseases, and rang the alarm bell for the world. Researchers in Botswana and Hong Kong also posted sequences publicly, and other cases have since been reported in Belgium, in Israel, and other places. The variant is likely in other countries, but researchers just haven't picked it up yet. It is not clear where the variant actually emerged. It could be that South Africa and Botswana saw it early because they have a strong genetic sequencing networks. Last Friday afternoon, the United States joined other countries in imposing travel restrictions from those two countries, as well as Zimbabwe, Namibia, Lesotho, Eswatini, Mozambique, and Malawi, effective Monday. Why is it causing concern? Several reasons. For one, it appears to be outcompeting other variants in South Africa, including the extremely transmissible Delta variant, and fast. It's starting to drive cases up in that country, which has already had several massive waves in its epidemic. Some possible explanations are that it's a better spreader than even Delta, that it can cause infections in people who are protected at higher rates, or some combination of the two. But beyond the epidemiological landscape in South Africa, scientists are concerned because of the number and variety of mutations that this variant has acquired. What Sharon Peacock, the director of COVID-19 Genomics UK Consortium, called, quote, a very unusual constellation of mutations. Some mutations have been previously seen in other variants and are associated with increased transmissibility and the ability to get around immune protection. Scientists can't predict how different mutations will behave when combined, but a particular worry to scientists is that the virus has some 32 mutations in its spike protein, which is what vaccines teach our immune system to recognize and target. The variant has a very high number of mutations with a concern for predictive immune evasion and transmissibility, said Tullia de Oliveira, director of the Center for Epidemic Response and Innovation, who helped identify the variant in South Africa. What does it mean for immune protection? If the spike protein changes, the antibodies elicited by vaccines or an earlier infection can't recognize it as well. The more changes, the more foreign that spike starts to look to the immune system. Vaccines generate what's called a polyclonal response, with lots of antibodies that recognize different pieces of the spike protein. Other variants have had mutations that cause changes in a particular spot on the protein called an antigenic site and might have thrown off those corresponding antibodies, but there were plenty of other antibodies that could still recognize the virus. But with a new variant, it has so many changes across the spike protein that nearly all the antigenic sites we know about are changed on this virus, said Wendy Barclay, who leads a UK group studying new variants of the SARS-CoV-2 coronavirus. That suggests, Barclay, that the ability of antibodies will be compromised in their ability to neutralize the virus, though she cautioned that scientists need to study that question to confirm it. So far, researchers don't know exactly what size dent the variant might have on vaccine effectiveness. The question of immune escape is one of degrees, not all or nothing. Some variants that have emerged so far have had more of an impact on vaccine effectiveness than others, though the vaccines so far have been able to keep up with the variants. Scientists have also found that it would take lots of escape mutations in the right spots to enable the virus to fully evade immunity. When a variant emerges, one of the primary questions is how well antibodies can still fight off the new form of the virus. But vaccines generate different layers of immune protection, including T cells. Scientists aren't sure yet what the impact of the variant might be on those, though T cells seem to have been less affected by mutations in other variants. T cell responses to new viruses are more complicated to study than antibody responses. However, studies have shown that neutralizing antibody levels can act as a correlate for how well protected someone is. One bit of good news, studies have suggested booster doses can, at least for a time, elicit such sky-high levels of antibodies that they can broadly withstand a mutated virus, even if the antibodies aren't targeting the specific viral proteins as well. Sometimes quantity can sort of compensate for the lack of a match, Barclay said. Ali El-Abadi, an immunologist at Washington University School of Medicine in St. Louis, said he finds the new variant very concerning, but thinks it will be much more of a threat if it takes off to people who are unimmunized or who didn't mount a strong response from the vaccine. It's not the same ground anymore, he said of the landscape of people susceptible to the virus. It's not as dry if you think of it as a fire. Yes, there are some dry patches, but there are some areas that have been damp and humid, and the fire is not going to find it easy. And that kind of makes sense because of that pre-existing immunity. He said manufacturers should be testing updated vaccines that protect against Omicron to be ready if it takes off. Beyond vaccines, the variant could have a greater impact on the effectiveness of the monoclonal antibodies used as therapeutics. How did it get so many mutations? The virus picked up so many mutations so quickly that scientists speculate the variant might not have come from the average case of COVID. Most people clear the virus after an acute infection, but sometimes people with compromised immune systems develop chronic COVID infections. The virus essentially lives in these people for an extended period of time and can rapidly accumulate mutations at a pace that viral evolution that occurs during normal transmission doesn't produce. Scientists have hypothesized something similar led to the emergence of the Alpha variant last year. Notably, the new variant is not a descendant of Delta. Delta has become so dominant globally that scientists had raised the idea that any future variant of concern would likely be a spin-out of that virus. How do scientists figure out what happens next? Scientists around the world have already launched investigations into the variant. For one, researchers will keep watching the situation epidemiologically. The variant took off in Africa when cases were quite low, so there's a chance that its apparent growth is a result of a few super-spreading events, for example, or tied to which cases are getting sequenced. But if it takes off in other countries, that will add to the evidence of its greater ability to spread. Scientists will study the virus in lab experiments to see how well antibodies generated by vaccines or past infections can still recognize and neutralize the variant. Vaccine makers have already said they're looking at the virus as well in case they need to update their shots. Researchers will also be looking as whether cases tied to this variant are more or less likely to cause severe disease. What does it mean for the rest of the world? It's too early to say. Some variants have taken off globally, take Delta, but other variants that cause concern, such as Beta and Gamma, never really established toeholds beyond the regions where they first emerged. Variants can behave differently in different places, depending on what other versions of the virus are circulating and also on the levels of protection in a given place. Why did the variant emerge? There's no real reason why a variant emerges. It's just the result of viral evolution. But the emergence of the variant, if it did start in an African country, which remains unknown, could underscore the message from health advocates that the massive inequities in vaccine access are a global problem. The higher the levels of transmission that are allowed to persist, the greater the chance of new worrisome variants. Only about 1 in 4 people in South Africa is fully immunized. Okay, well, it remains to be seen. Will this Omicron variant come to be known as the Omicron variant? Well, only time will tell. And we'll probably know a lot more within 2 or 3 weeks. But of course, it's going to take months to get a lot of scientific evidence on it. And of course, the spread around the world will take weeks and months. So by the time we see this in the U.S., which we inevitably will be a while still. But be prepared. Thing I'm keeping eye on, like other variants of concern, is I'm very concerned about to be able to break through previous infection, natural infection, for people who've been infected but have not been immunized. While natural infection provides some protection from reinfection, there have been other variants that have cut through that natural infection protection rather well. And what that would mean for the U.S. is it looks like we've got a pretty wide swath of people that are probably never going to get the vaccine or not anytime soon. And if that's the case, a lot of them have already been infected. But if they're now firewood to be thrown on a fire for reinfection with a new variant, that could change the landscape of the epidemic that we see in this country and, of course, other places in the world, particularly where there's been a lot of viral transmission and a lot of people infected. If it cuts through that infection, that's very bad news. Okay, well, where we're at today with the Delta variant widespread across the world is bad enough. This from the New York Times. Europe's death toll from COVID will exceed 2 million by spring, the World Health Organization says. Europe's death toll from COVID will exceed 2 million people by next spring, the World Health Organization projected last Tuesday, adding that the continent remained, quote, firmly in the grip of the COVID-19 pandemic. COVID is now the leading cause of death in Europe, the agency said in a statement, with almost 4,200 new deaths a day, double the number at the end of September. To date, Europe, including Britain and Russia, has reported 1.5 million deaths. Between now and the spring, hospital beds in 25 countries and intensive care units in 49 countries are predicted to experience high or extreme stress, the World Health Organization said. Dr. Hans Kluge, a regional director for the WHO, said Europe faced a challenging winter. In order to live with this virus and continue our daily lives, we need to take a vaccine-plus approach, he said. That means getting vaccinations or booster shots if offered, and taking other preventive measures to avoid the reimposing of lockdowns, like calling on the public to wear masks and maintain physical distance, he said. Over 1 billion vaccine doses have been administered in Europe. About 53% of the population is fully vaccinated. But countries have gaping disparities in vaccination rates, the organization said, and it was essential to drive the lagging rates up, the officials said. In recent days, European countries have imposed restrictions to try to curb the highest surges of new cases in the region since the pandemic began. Austria began its fourth lockdown last Monday, and Germany is pressuring its citizens to get vaccinated. Slovakia, Liechtenstein, and the Czech Republic have the world's highest rates of new cases in proportion to their populations. This story is a good reminder that vaccination is not the only means we have to prevent infection and is not the only thing we rely on to keep prevention from happening. But of course, back in the U.S., people are relaxing and going back to normal. This next story from The Hill. 3 in 4 Americans say their lives are back to, quote, normal, says poll. A new Yahoo News YouGov poll found 74% of Americans say their lives are, quote, normal again after almost 2 years of living under the coronavirus pandemic. The survey indicated that 21% described their lives as very normal, and 53% said their lives are somewhat normal when factoring in the impact of the COVID-19. Only 19% in the poll said their lives were not very normal, and 7% said their lives were not normal at all. Although unvaccinated individuals made up a majority of hospitalizations and deaths since the vaccines became widely available, the majority of those who are unvaccinated seem least concerned about the virus. The poll found 70% of unvaccinated Americans described their lives as normal, with 25% saying their lives are very normal and 27% saying their lives never stopped being normal. Only 19% of vaccinated Americans say their lives are very normal, and 8% say their lives never stopped being normal. Another indicator of the great divide between the perspectives of those vaccinated and those unvaccinated. but in a very real way, we're in this together, and COVID-19 is alive and well.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me. But the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, well, this next story from Medical Express gets at how so-called COVID-19 pandemic fatigue affects different populations and what importance it makes. Social stress, key to population's rate of COVID-19 infection, study finds. An international team of researchers led by Professor Alexander Gorban from the University of Leicester used available data from 13 countries to determine the rate of stress response or mobilization and the rate of spontaneous exhaustion or demobilization. The study analyzed data from China, the USA, UK, Germany, Colombia, Italy, Spain, Israel, Russia, France, Brazil, India, and Iran, and contributed to the research team's proposed new systems of models which combine the dynamics of the established concept of social stress with classic epidemic models. They measured how variable countries are in two processes: mobilization of people for rational protective behavior and exhaustion of this mobilization with destroying of rational behavior. Researchers determined that the large difference between COVID-19 spread between countries is caused by social differences through response to the established sociological concept of social stress. This states that susceptible individuals will pass through a cycle of three modes: ignorance, living without restrictions; resistance, individuals consciously and actively practicing social distancing measures; and exhaustion, the depletion of the person's capacity to follow social distancing measures. The rate at which the cycle repeats is largely driven by a population stress response rate and the rate at which the population becomes exhausted by social distancing measures. Colombia, Iran, and the U.S. showed the highest exhaustion rates of the countries in the study, with the U.K. at the median rate. China's stress response was the highest of the 13 countries analyzed, reflecting a rapid and dramatic spread of the virus among the human population. After a large initial spike, cases and morbidity rates dropped sharply due to a highly unified society response. So there you go. Obviously, when you demobilize, it leads to greater increases. But of course, a lot of the demobilization is, quote, rational in the sense that it's intentional, that people have decided, for instance, not to mask up or to social distance or to get vaccinated. We also have an epidemic of misinformation and propaganda. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real, and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. Okay, well, it seems that the medical model in dealing with this pandemic is alive and well, is that even with people that trust the effectiveness of vaccines are also relying heavily, obviously, on pharmaceuticals, whether it's vaccines or pills to antiviral pills, for instance, in order to treat or other treatments. So we got a couple stories here about that, these new antiviral pills that are being put through for approval and what impact they may have. And of course, there is some mistrust that is and should be held about pharmaceutical companies. This from Stat News. New data analysis of some analyses take some of the shine off Merck's COVID pill. New data, in addition to analyses by scientists at the Food and Drug Administration, may take some of the shine off Merck's experimental COVID-19 pill. Last Friday, the drug maker released full results from its study of the pill, molnupiravir, whatever, showing it reduced the risk of hospitalization by 30%, down from a decrease of 50% seen in an earlier analysis. The data were released by the FDA published as the FDA published its own analysis of the drug ahead of a meeting of advisors being convened by the agency to vote on whether the medicine's benefits outweigh its risk. In that analysis, FDA researchers seemed to favor the authorization of the new drug, but raised concerns that could mean people who are at lower risk from that disease would not be offered the pill. And that's the concern of this next article. Of course, there's two drugs that are being pushed through for authorization. This from Stat News. COVID antivirals could be pandemic game changers, but Americans might struggle to access them. And this is what we've learned with vaccinations. A vaccination on the shelf doesn't do nearly as much good as a vaccination that's actually in somebody's arms. And the same is true for these antiviral drugs for treating COVID-19. Antiviral drugs for treating COVID-19 have been hailed as a pandemic game changer, a tool that could, perhaps, finally help life return to normal. But basic gaps in the U.S. health system could mean that the two new treatments from Pfizer and Merck won't make much of a difference after all. The company's treatments, which haven't yet received emergency authorization, could make a COVID diagnosis dramatically less threatening. But in practice, before receiving the pills, patients may need to jump through a series of hoops that often prevent Americans from accessing care: recognizing their symptoms, taking a test, getting a prescription from a clinician, and filling the prescription at a pharmacy. Our routine medical systems are not really set up for this, said Celine Gounder, a physician and NYU professor who served on President Biden's COVID advisory board in the months before his inauguration. These are medications that need to be started within 3 days of developing symptoms. It can take you longer than 3 days to get an appointment. The skepticism surrounding the antivirals highlights the country's continued lack of basic pandemic response infrastructure, even 22 months after the country's first recorded case of COVID-19. And it highlights, too, that despite profoundly successful partnerships between the U.S. government and major pharmaceutical companies, the country's health system often fails to deliver life-saving vaccines and medicines to those at highest risk. To make matters worse, access to the antiviral drugs could potentially break down across typical lines of income and race, echoing the country's initial struggle to vaccinate many of society's most medically vulnerable, as well as historically marginalized communities. Many of the people who would be at highest risk, people with chronic illnesses, people who may not have been vaccinated, individuals who largely don't have health care, people who may not have a primary care doctor, these are the people who are most likely to benefit from antivirals, but may be those who are least likely to receive them, said Adam Gaffney, a Harvard Medical School professor and progressive health policy advocate. But it might be difficult to get the drugs outside of a clinical trial setting. Depending on the particular patient, it could involve four individual steps: recognizing symptoms, receiving a positive COVID-19 test result, being prescribed an antiviral by a doctor, and picking up the pills at a nearby pharmacy. Each step could prove difficult, Gaffney said, beginning with the challenge of recognizing symptoms during winter, when early signs of COVID-19 might be easily written off as cold, flu, or allergies. Even if patients do quickly suspect they have COVID, diagnostic tests are still sometimes hard to come by. Many of the patients who test positive won't have primary care physicians, and perhaps worse, the antivirals are ideally taken just 3 days after symptom onset, meaning the four-step process can't face any setbacks. Of all the challenges patients will face when seeking the antiviral treatments, the lack of access to efficient testing is by far the largest. That puts the U.S. at odds with other high-income countries, like the United Kingdom, where the government is shipping rapid COVID-19 tests for free to anybody who asks. And even for people who have access to testing, some PCR diagnostics need to be shipped to a lab that won't return a result for 24 hours at least. It has to be one-stop shopping, Gounder said. There can't be multiple steps to all of it. There might be a few different such pathways. One might be that you walk into your local drugstore, which I think for a lot of people is the most likely. The Biden administration has already moved to make that a reality, anticipating that the Food and Drug Administration will likely authorize the drugs for emergency use. In a little notice of regulatory move, the Department of Health and Human Services announced on September 14 that pharmacists can prescribe, dispense, and administer COVID-19 therapeutics. The administration has solved one early concern about broad access to antivirals. Since the federal government has purchased them in advance, they'll largely be free to patients similar to COVID-19 vaccines. Still, experts caution that while the antivirals at best are a valuable tool in the country's COVID-fighting arsenal, they're no cure-all. It's unlikely, Gaffney said, that these drugs are going to be the silver bullet that ends this pandemic. Well, one more tool, but is embedded in the complexity of many public health problems, most long-standing before the pandemic. Well, the pandemic has affected us in many ways, and here's a new one they're reporting on, this from Stat News. The pandemic has deeply affected many people with eating disorders. Reported in the Journal of American Medical Association Network Open, data from a large national health insurer showed substantial increases in hospitalizations among people with anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, and other eating disorders, such as binge eating disorder, starting in the second half of 2020. Hospitalization rates for these conditions roughly doubled compared to the rates of the prior 2 years, and individuals admitted to the hospital tended to stay about 50% longer, suggesting the disorders were more severe. We saw no changes in outpatient visits or hospitalizations for other common mental health conditions like depression, alcohol use, or opioid use, suggesting that the pandemic is having a particular effect on people susceptible to eating disorders. Although it isn't entirely clear to us why this is happening, understanding some of the reasons can help families and clinicians recognize these problems earlier and provide appropriate services. First, messaging about the link between obesity and the severity of COVID-19 and our connections between self-quarantine and weight gain have likely been hard on people susceptible to eating disorders. These messages may have prompted some to engage in restrictive eating behaviors, such as refusing to eat certain foods or labeling foods as good or bad, which can lead to more severe weight loss in those with anorexia and to more severe binge eating and compensatory behaviors, such as vomiting or laxative use, among those with bulimia. Second, especially in the beginning of the pandemic, grocery shopping became a more complicated and difficult task due to fears of contracting COVID-19 in public places like grocery stores, the limited availability of some foods and household items, and strict rules and rituals for shoppers. Food shopping, an already anxiety-provoking task for individuals prone to eating disorders, became even more difficult. Third, during the pandemic, many people bought large quantities of processed, prepackaged comfort foods to minimize how often they needed to shop and out of concern for food shortages. Being confined at home in close proximity to these foods likely led to increases in mindless eating and snacking for many people, as well as binging episodes for those prone to eating disorders, particularly since people had fewer distractions and distance from food. Fourth, exercise is one of the few activities promoted as safe and healthy during the pandemic. For many individuals with eating disorders, exercise may have become a way to control an uncontrollable situation or a compensatory mechanism for eating. In one recent study, a majority of patients with anorexia who had participated in treatment in 2019 reported during the pandemic that they had increased concerns about eating, body shape, and weight, a higher drive for physical activity, and more loneliness, sadness, and inner restlessness. Fifth, social anxiety, stress, and depressed mood often go hand in hand with eating disorders and all worsen during this time. These five factors likely increase eating disorder symptoms, but a collection of other circumstances may have made eating disorders easier to discover and perhaps harder to treat. Stay-at-home orders, remote schooling, and the closure of college campuses may have helped families better identify unhealthy rapid weight loss or binge eating, or more clearly see its psychological burdens, leading family members to seek treatment for their loved ones. At the same time, outpatient facilities struggling to adapt their operations during the pandemic may not have had additional capacity to see these patients when their symptoms warranted a lower level of care, thus delaying treatment and intensifying the eating disorder. Similarly, fears of contracting COVID-19 may have influenced individuals and family members to delay seeking care until symptoms were severe enough to require inpatient care. Food is a large part of life. For those with eating disorders, food and its rituals are also great sources of anxiety. Many people living with these disorders have struggled even more during the pandemic. As it shifts and society adjusts to a new normal, it's important to recognize the burden the pandemic continues to impose on people with eating disorders. In a society where appearance is highly prized, eating disorders are often considered less important and more under the control of those who experience them than other mental health disorders. The pandemic highlights the need to understand the particular triggers for individuals with eating disorders, identify the symptoms, and provide appropriate and early treatment. Okay, well, that's some bad news about the effects of the pandemic. Let's get to something a little bit better news, this from Medical Express. We expected people with asthma to fare worse during COVID, but it turns out they've had a break. There were fears at the beginning of the COVID pandemic that people with asthma would fare much worse than those without it. Intuitively, a disease that attacks the lungs should put asthma sufferers at much greater risk, but this hasn't been borne out. First, it's turned out people with asthma are at slightly lower risk of acquiring COVID, being hospitalized with it, or indeed dying from it compared to people without asthma. Though someone with asthma who is hospitalized with COVID is slightly more likely to require ICU admission. In addition, asthma attacks have substantially reduced in many parts of the world. What explains this? Asthma is an umbrella term for a range of diseases of the airways which have similar outcomes, constriction of the airways causing difficulty breathing. In some forms of asthma, the constriction is a result of inflammation or rash within the lung. Many people with asthma take asthma preventers, which are a type of steroid drug, which lung experts call inhaled corticosteroids. These drugs reduce the amount of inflammation in the lungs. Interestingly, another steroid, dexamethasone, is being used as a treatment for COVID for the same reason. Asthmatics might be inadvertently reducing the risk of severe COVID if they contract it by regularly using the preventers, because they are, quote, pre-treated, if you like. Indeed, some preventers are thought to be anti-SARS-CoV-2, that is, they have some ability to kill the virus that causes COVID. What's more, some good evidence from Australia demonstrates that patients with asthma have decreased ACE2 gene expression. ACE2 is the point of entry for the SARS-CoV-2 virus to get into your cells. If you have less ACE2, then there are fewer gateways for the virus to enter our cells, and there's less opportunity for infection to take hold. There are a number of possible reasons why asthma attacks have declined. Asthma is a chronic condition which can flare up when sufferers are exposed to their triggers. Common ones are pollen, chemicals, dust mites, pets, mold, smoke, or viruses. Social distancing and locking down millions of people around the world has been a real case study in what staying at home would do to asthma rates. Because people in lockdown go outside a lot less, it could reduce their exposure to pollen and other allergens and irritants outdoors such as smoke, thereby reducing asthma attacks. What's more, social distancing and lockdowns also significantly reduce the number of interactions between people, thereby reducing the spread of infectious diseases. We've been able to reduce COVID this way and flu cases as well. Along with this, we can presume there have been far fewer common colds and other types of infectious diseases. Viruses can cause asthma flare-ups, which is known by lung experts as viral exacerbation of asthma, so fewer people with colds and the flu could also contribute to lower asthma attack rates. Okay, well, let's end our COVID coverage by doing the local update, and the summary is things are not getting better, and in many ways they're getting worse. The Lucas County average daily number of cases over the last 7 days stayed about the same, although this was the holiday week with Thanksgiving last week, where there was a lot of people traveling on the holiday, so there was less testing and also less reporting. So we've seen in the past that there's usually a dip down, and it'll probably likely continue up the way it has before. But that's one of the vagaries of the surveillance system and the testing patterns. But to kind of confirm that things are getting worse, we actually had more people that were tested in the most recent week, but also the testing positivity rate went up in Lucas County from 12.4% to 15.5%. Whew, over 3% in a one-week period. In Ohio, it also went up from 12.7 to 14%. That's getting in really dangerous territory. And the U.S. as a whole is better off than Ohio is, but the testing positivity rate went from 6.4% to 7.2%. Nursing homes, we did see a jump in Lucas County. The long-term care facilities had 70 active cases. That's 39 residents and 31 staff. Fortunately, we didn't see any additional deaths of long-term care facility residents. In schools, we saw about the same, maybe a touch higher in Lucas County schools. We had 34 staff and 183 students identified as COVID positive in the most recent week. We did see a little bit of a bigger increase, somewhat of an increase in the state as a whole, where the state had 962 staff and, 1,075 staff identified with COVID-19 and almost 5,400 students. Also at UT, which this is its first full week of reporting after this November 5th deadline for mandating vaccines or subjecting to weekly testing. And probably isn't a good example that you can't vaccinate your way out of the problem, and that social distancing, masking, etc. is also very important, is that cases identified in University Toledo campus went up to 58 from 38 the previous week. And the surveillance testing, they tested about 1,000 people, had 14 positives for a 1.4% positivity rate, which is the highest they've had for a while. So it's not subsiding. Hospitalizations are continuing to rise steadily in both Lucas County and Ohio. And Lucas County actually has had the highest number of COVID-19 hospitalizations or people in the hospital since we've been keeping track of it. Now, there's a slight little difference here. You have hospital admissions, which is the number of people that are admitted to the hospital. The number of people that are hospitalized at any time, and that's what's been the highest, is actually a little bit different indicator. It's more of an indication of the severity of disease. You know, if people just go in and they're there 1, 2, 3, 4 days, then, you know, 5 days later, they won't be counted as being hospitalized. But if they're in for 3 or 4 weeks, they're going to be counted as hospitalized for a long time. So the amount of people that are hospitalized at any given time is a better indicator of the actual severity of disease. And that's what we've peaked out in Lucas County. So, folks, it's the worst it's been with for hospitalized folks in Lucas County. Not a good indicator. And, of course, deaths nationally are edging back up. We're back up to over 1,100 deaths each day. A weird thing happens with tracking the fully vaccinated. This is the first time that in the U.S., the number of people fully vaccinated did not even go up 0.1%. This probably belies the fact that we've been focusing on getting boosters, which is getting to be about 11% of the people that are eligible have gotten boosters. In Ohio, it went up 0.2% in the most recent week, and it went up 0.1% in Lucas County for people newly fully vaccinated. So that is really dropping. Again, not a good sign. Even the increases we've had in the last several weeks doesn't seem to have led to an increase yet in vaccinations. The rate, the speed by which we get vaccinated in Ohio and Lucas County, even though we're more of an epicenter. Not as bad as Michigan. There's always somebody worse, it seems, but we are still in the thick of it. You are listening to WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. This is Just for the Health of It, the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, we're in the midst of the holiday seasons, and that leads us to this next story from Discover Magazine. 'Tis the season to feel stress and sadness. We often have huge expectations for the holidays. We imagine our friends and family assembling to share a scrumptious meal, to trade presents, and to generally get along. And yet the holidays seldom play out the way we envision. For many, the season instead fosters feelings of sadness and stress. Those feelings alongside fatigue, frustration, and anxiety are all signs of the holiday blues, a temporary malaise that troubles millions of individuals each year, according to the National Alliance on Mental Illness. For them, even simple activities can become tiresome. Sometimes they see changes to their appetite and sleep schedule, or struggle to appreciate activities they previously found fun. If these symptoms seem reminiscent of other heavy-hitting mental health issues, including depression and anxiety, there's a pretty good reason. According to the National Association of Mental Illness, Alliance on Mental Illness, 64% of people already diagnosed with a mental illness say that holidays exacerbated their symptoms. Let's get into why. Of course, no one needs a diagnosis to feel fatigued, frustrated, or overwhelmed throughout the season. Psychologists point out that anyone can become bogged down by holiday blues, an ailment that differs from depressive disorders, anxiety disorders, and seasonal affective disorder, a debilitating condition that coincides with seasonal changes in sunlight and can be present for as much as 40% of the year. According to Elaine Rodino, a Pennsylvania psychologist in private practice, the biggest distinction is that holiday blues are temporary, typically appearing around November and fading in January without therapy or other treatment. These feelings should dissipate, she says. If they continue for several weeks beyond the holidays, then maybe something deeper is going on and the person may need psychological help. Another important distinction is that the holiday blues are situational, appearing thanks to circumstances and without the internal chemical causes that characterize disorders such as depression and anxiety. Though these conditional triggers come in all shapes and sizes, the following often appear as a common source to such feelings. Family frustration. The prospects of passing time in the company of family can create feelings of anxiety and anger if it recalls past trauma and negativity. Some people have very unhappy holiday memories, Rodino says. They grew up in families where there was perhaps alcoholism and violence, and holidays would usually end up unhappy and traumatic. When the holidays come, they try not to think of those memories, but the memories are there. Social separation and loss. People separated from their friends and family frequently feel longing, loneliness, and isolation throughout the holidays. These feelings also intensify for individuals stumbling through the loss of a loved one. Financial fatigue. For individuals struggling to make ends meet, surviving through the season can seem impossible and might even foster feelings of powerlessness or inadequacy. These days, there are a lot of people that are suffering financially because of COVID-19. The whole pandemic has increased the burden. These situations, she adds, are not isolated to the holiday season. Rather than produce new problems, the season simply intensifies the issues and feelings that individuals face at any other time of the year. They most likely will go through this in the same way they handle other times when they may be sad or anxious, Rodino says. The holiday hype. At the core of this intensification, Rodino says, are the high hopes that the holiday season holds. The media does a pretty intense job of hyping up the holidays. Traditional holiday imagery shows families present and content, speaking amiably and piling up presents to share. The standard is idealized and almost impossible to accomplish, she says, though many individuals strive to attain the unattainable. When people feel that they can't achieve that, or they try to achieve that and it doesn't quite work, they feel somehow they failed, that they're inadequate. Many professionals agree that unreasonable aspirations are a significant source of dissatisfaction. There's this tradition of holidays, says Pauline Whalen, a Pennsylvania psychologist in private practice. The holidays don't measure up to the ideal. Even those who anticipate the festivities all year can frequently find themselves stressed in preparation. While not many surveys have measured the holiday blues on a wide scale, one notable assessment by the American Psychological Association in 26 showed that approximately 38% of Americans reported increased stress during the holidays. A further 25% suffer from frequent fatigue, 20% from frequent stress, and 7% from frequent sadness. Thankfully, psychologists say there are several strategies you can use to mitigate these issues. Make plans. Act deliberately and decisively about your activities throughout the season, prioritizing particular celebrations and avoiding overscheduling. Try to think about a plan about how you want to spend the holidays and who you want to spend them with. Don't become a victim of the holidays. Take control. Seek support. Though it's tempting to spend the time alone, try to speak to someone supportive and create social connections. Reach out to others. Think about somebody in your circle or in your neighborhood that would appreciate a phone call saying, "I'm thinking of you," because that takes the focus off yourself. It's also important to accept kindnesses from loved ones. Often family and friends realize that the person is going through their first holiday alone, Rodina says. They try to include you and take extra good care. I stress that people should allow their friends and family to take care of them. It's a show of love and caring. Set sensible expectations. Remember that attempting to achieve perfection is a surefire strategy to feel frustrated, fatigued, and insufficient. Avoid comparing yourself, your friends, and your family to the ideal swirling around the season. When you compare yourself with others, we ultimately feel worse, Wallen says. Instead, set your sights on a realistic season and concentrate on things that are successful to reroute attention from imperfections. Being grateful for what you have is another thing that is helpful. Spot spiraling symptoms. Finally, if your feelings of sadness intensify or persist, it could indicate something serious, such as depression or anxiety disorder. All these feelings that we're talking about are on a continuum, Rodino adds. If a person does see some more serious symptoms and they last longer than a few weeks beyond the holidays, then they should talk with a psychologist. All in all, psychologists advise people to treat themselves compassionately. It is good for people to know that this is a condition that's pretty normal, that they're not alone, and that it ends, Rodino says. It's short-lived. Well, I hope you all find many things to be grateful for in this holiday season. Okay, and some good news. Close off with a couple stories that are a little bit more good news. This from Stat News. Jury holds pharmacies responsible for role in opioid crisis. CVS, Walgreens, and Walmart pharmacies recklessly distributed massive amounts of pain pills in two Ohio counties, a federal jury said last Tuesday, in a verdict that could set the tone for U.S. city and county governments that want to hold pharmacies accountable for their roles in the opioid crisis. Lake and Trumbull counties blamed the three chain pharmacies for not stopping the flood of pills that caused hundreds of overdose deaths and cost each of the two counties about $1 billion, their attorney said. How much the pharmacies must pay in damages will be decided in the spring by a federal judge. It was the first time pharmacy companies had completed a trial to defend themselves in a drug crisis that has killed 500,000 Americans over the past two decades. The counties were able to convince the jury that the pharmacies played an outsized role in creating a public nuisance in a way that they dispense pain medication into their communities. The law requires pharmacies to be diligent in dealing drugs. This case should be a wake-up call that failure will not be accepted, said Mark Lanier, an attorney for the counties. Two other chains, Rite Aid and Giant Eagle, already had settled lawsuits with two Ohio counties. Lanier said during the trial the pharmacies were attempting to blame everyone but themselves. The opioid crisis has overwhelmed courts, social service agencies, and law enforcement in Ohio's blue-collar corner east of Cleveland, leaving behind heartbroken families and babies born to addicted mothers. Roughly 80 million prescription painkillers were dispensed in Trumbull County alone between 2012 and 2016, equivalent to 400 for every resident. The county said pharmacy should be the last line of defense to prevent the pills from getting into the wrong hands, that they didn't hire enough pharmacists and technicians or train them to stop that from happening, and failed to implement systems that could flag suspicious orders, Lanier said. The trial before U.S. District Judge Dan Polster in Cleveland was part of a broader constellation of federal opioid lawsuits, about 3,000 in all, that have been consolidated under the judge's supervision. Other cases are moving ahead in state courts.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment, from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones, from daily sexism that can't be mansplained away, from endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever. Callus always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, I want to end the show with a little bit of better news. As the COP26 climate conference has ended, I think as a whole it's been rather large failure. But there is some advances, and we'll take any win we can get. And this Washington Post story gets at one of those, specifically related to public health. COP26 finally framed climate change as a public health issue, experts say. More than 100 doctors and nurses traveled to Glasgow with a message for world leaders. Global warming is a leading threat to public health, and curbing planet warming emissions is a prescription. That message resonated at COP26 more than it has at previous United Nations climate summits, according to experts who have been attending the talks for years. I have been coming to these for the last 12 years, and I have seen how certain topics have gained more relevance, and certainly public health is one of them, Ramon Cruz, president of the Sierra Club's board of directors, told the Climate 202. Jenny Miller, executive director of the Global Climate and Health Alliance, who has gone to 5 UN climate summits, agreed with that assessment. She noted that the World Health Organization sponsored a health pavilion at COP26 for the first time in the organization's history. The WHO pavilion sounds like maybe a small thing, Miller told the Climate 202, but it made health, in a very literal sense of the term, visible at the COP. It created a physical space that people could walk by and countries' delegations could see. Even before the conference in Glasgow, there was a growing recognition in the medical profession that rising global temperatures imperil millions of lives. The Lancet, a top medical journal, warned in October that climate change is set to become, quote, the defining narrative of human health, as my colleague Sarah Kaplan reported at the time. In a special report, the WHO also called climate change, quote, the single biggest health threat facing humanity, noting that its effects could be more catastrophic than the coronavirus pandemic. Miller also noted that burning fossil fuels, a primary driver of climate change, releases air pollutants that can trigger asthma and other respiratory conditions. Fine particle pollution from burning fossil fuels causes roughly 4 million people to die prematurely each year, the research shows. Fossil fuels are killing us, Miller said, adding that the science supports setting up clear targets for phasing out coal, the worst offender. In addition to the link between fine particle pollution and respiratory conditions, climate change has menaced human health in the U.S. and globally in a variety of ways. For example, smoke from wildfires in California over the summer infiltrated the lungs and then the bloodstreams of people as far away as New York, Ohio, and Texas. Rising temperatures have led to higher rates of heat illness, causing people to collapse in their homes when a heat dome roasted the Pacific Northwest in June. In Madagascar, extreme drought has caused crops to fail, leaving tens of thousands of people suffering from severe hunger and food insecurity, leading the UN to warn of the world's first climate change-induced famine. The good news is that doctors increasingly are keeping climate effects in mind when treating patients, says Renee Salas, an emergency medicine physician at Massachusetts General Hospital, who attended COP26. If you come in with an asthma attack to my emergency department, that's your primary diagnosis. But yet, climate change is driving pollen levels to be higher, so it is actually a secondary diagnosis, Salas said during a panel last week hosted by Harvard University's School of Public Health. Salas concluded her remarks with a call to action. Doctors and nurses must have an even greater impact on the next round of UN climate talks, known as COP27, which will be hosted by Egypt in 2022. So let's keep the pressure on. Okay, well, we're going to close the show with some bonus articles. Have 4 articles this week, and I'll give the link to view those. You can see these articles, these 4 that I list, or any of the articles that I've reported on this show at the website I'll give. First up, 1, the evidence is piling up that pregnant people should get vaccinated. Yes, sirree, folks. You know, when they do clinical trials for vaccinations, one of the subgroups that's the trickiest to deal with is pregnant people. But with the experience we've had with the pandemic so far, it is way safer. Actually, vaccines seem to be safe, but definitely COVID is not if you're pregnant. Okay, 2, if you want to do a deep dive into COVID, if you haven't had enough news, this is a good one. Virus expert Trevor Bedford on annual COVID boosters and the inevitable next pandemic. 3 is a very interesting article, a little bit longer read. Organized crime is a top driver of global forestation, along with beef, soy, palm oil, and wood products. I like this one particularly with the title because it puts organized crime as a social determinant of health, where obviously global deforestation and climate change is a determinant of health. And one of the realities in dealing with climate change is that, of course, a lot of these agreements rely upon legalities, but a lot of the bad behavior that's happening that's affecting global deforestation is coming from organized crime, so it's something else we need to deal with. Now, of course, organized crime is actually a large driver in global deforestation, but the big number one is beef. And some of the other ones listed there, soy is a little bit weird one because you think of soy as a food, but almost 80% of soy is used to feed animals. So actually soy is really a proxy for animal-based foods. And only about 6% of global soy production is actually eaten as something that resembles soy. That would be basically foods not including soybean oil. And last but not least, number four, laugh a little. Medical professionals engaged in serious business need to reclaim their humor. Obviously, some of this public health and medical news can get a little bit dry. I always try to throw a little bit of laughter in there. It's better. You have to keep laughing in order to not cry. You can view these stories and all the other ones I've reported in the show by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some